Ah, hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode 238, I was very privileged, lucky to have Morgan Quaid on the podcast today. How can I put it? He is a musician, a novelist, a graphic novelist, a comic book writer. He is a man, I got to say, who has a plan and he's on the go. Mr. Nonstop. We talked about many things today, how he got into his realm of his comic book life. And yes, how he moved from being a novelist, to a novelist, to being a comic book writer in this day and age. We talked about how he got things started on his Kickstarter, what sort of things you need to do to get a comic book, started and going. And yeah, we talked about, the sort of the power of the story as well. All in all, he is a great guy. Enjoyed talking to him. And yeah, I look forward to his return. So please sit back, enjoy the show. And yes, have a good one. Yeah. Peace. Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors. Wherever you are in the world, welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode, where are we today? 238. I am very lucky, honored, privileged to have Morgan Quaid on the podcast. Now, look. Now, with little Morgan here, I can't really call him little because, look, this man has had a background in music, like performing, having a good time on that. And then he decided to get into the realm of comic books, which I've got to say, hey, that is, I have nothing against comic books. I do love a good comic book myself. Now, way back when, I suffered through the early 90s of, comic madness, but that's another story. I shall move away from this. It is a dark times for me. Much money was spent. Let's move. Morgan, how are you today?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me on. Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to chatting about comics and music and anything.
You are an interesting cat, to say the least, because anyone who goes, yes, I'm involved in comics. It's like you go, when did you fall in love with comics? I have this long, rich history. When I was a child, when I picked up my first comic with my mama, I went, this is the life for me. You didn't have that path, did you now?
I did not have that path. No, I was never really into comics when I was a kid. Partly, I think, because it confused my brain a little bit, that having words and the pictures, and I never quite knew. It was either too many words take my attention away from the pictures, or too many pictures to take my attention away. So I could never quite get the hang of it. Never really got into the superhero thing. It just wasn't. I mean, I was big into Star Wars and that sort of thing, because I was a kid of the 70s. Who wasn't? But, never really got into comic books. So it was really late in life that I discovered comic books, which is a bit weird.
So what drew you into comics? Because look, you've had, just looking at your background, it says a certain, you're a certain type of person. I'm just saying, look, man, how many guitars can one person have?
Too many. Yeah, and they're just the ones you can see as well. You can't see the other ones that are hidden away because I've run out of room. Yeah, too many guitars. But they're like shoes, I guess, for some people. I need them all, and I need more.
I'm not gonna say anything about your compulsion right there. I looked at my lady's shoe collection. I was like, Imelda Marcos, say no more. And yeah, she's vastly reduced it. I think they would be able to give her a pair of shoes for everyone in, the Lower London area. That's another story. So you're like, you're like, the music side of things. So you were in music for how long? I have to ask.
Well, I still am. So I was in a band, a few bands, and gigging around for a fairly short amount of time, about 15 years ago. I was terrible at it because I hate going out. I hate waiting. And if you know anything about gigging, you're going out and you're waiting because, you know, you might get there at 7 at night and you're not playing until 1, and you don't know that until you turn up. So I hated it. I love the people, love the music, but God, it was just terrible. Just such a curmudgeonly old dude, even though I was young. So, yeah, I only did that for a while. But then I got into music for film and TV, and then producing for indie artists and that sort of stuff. So I got more behind the scenes producing and making music, but not up in front of a stage where people can throw stuff at you. Yeah, which I prefer. I prefer to be further away from the throwing of beer bottles and such, you know.
I see. You seem like you have the reflexes of someone who's had a number of things thrown at them in the past. So I'm going,
yeah.
It's like, Morpheus, I can see the Matrix. Like,
I have bruises. Yeah, I have many, many bruises. But yeah, it wasn't my thing. It just wasn't my. I remember playing, because obviously guitar was my main instrument. Mm. I remember playing there and looking out at the crowd and just thinking, man, I wouldn't come out on a Friday night to a gig. Why are you even here? This doesn't make any sense. So I wasn't really the poster boy for bands. Whereas the production side, you get all the music, you get the creativity and all the fun and all that. You still get to work with artists and all that sort of stuff, but you don't have that. I have to turn up and I have to do it at night with the crowd and all that sort of stuff, which is, don't get me wrong, it's great.
Yeah.
But everything in between that period where you're on stage is I hated all of the rest of it. So yeah, so I still do that though. I still the money that I make from the music is actually what funds the artwork for the comics, because comics are, if you're unaware, hugely expensive to make. They're not cheap things to make, because you've got to pay an artist to do all the artwork, and effectively every page is like a piece of artwork, and every panel on every page is a mini piece of artwork. So huge amount of work, huge amount of expense. So that's where the music still comes in. And it's great fun. I can't give music up. It's awesome.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you, because, like, this is the thing. You bring up the sort of realms of cost, because, like, yeah, it's, people don't realize. And, like, this is the thing. I am not elbows deep in the comic world, but I do know one or two things about it. And when you mention artists doing each page, then each panel, but it's not just that simple either, because you've got to get someone to ink the damn thing. Yep. As well, because, like, yep. And people don't realize, it's like, okay, when you watch a film, it's like you get different gradients, right, on film.
Yeah.
And yeah, that sometimes sets the whole tone and mood for any movie you watch, any TV show you watch. And if you don't get it right, you kind of lose something in the essence. And trying to find that right person to do the inking, yeah, must be a very hard challenge to do, to get that essence. If you get what I mean,
it is. Sorry, and I'm just going to stick my hand right up there because I've gone out of focus and I don't know what's going on. See if that doesn't work. Anyway, blurry will improve some of the imperfections, so we'll go with it. yeah. So with comics, it's if you're doing it the so-called right way, then you have someone that writes a script. So you have the writer that writes the script. You may have an editor that edits the script as well. Then you go to a penciler, the artist that draws the main outlines of everything, and they would do rough sketches initially. And then once you approve those, then they do the detailed drawings, still with pencils. Then you have an inker. And with each of these professions, there are excellent and there are mid-grade and there are not so good or just starting off. So, and the money goes up depending on what you pick. So you would get an inker that would ink them. Then you get a colorist that would color them. Then you get a letterer that adds the text in at the end, which most creators like myself, we do ourselves because it saves money and time and all the rest of it. But if you're doing that, you're paying for 6 or 7 people for one book. So that's where the cost can come in. So anything that you can do to sort of improve that and reduce the cost without reducing the quality is a smart move. Mm. But not easy, and it's a lot of effort from a lot of people for just a fairly small book that, you know, is fun to read.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, good God. Yeah. So, what would be the sort of typical cost, like, for, okay, I would say a 20-page or 30-page sort of comic, just comic book? I think that should be, if I remember rightly, around about the sort of level it should be at.
Yeah, most are 22, 24, around about that. The most that I do are 30 to 40, because I'm a glutton for punishment. And I think if you're reading a story, I want a meaty story, so I'll do more. So you're usually looking at around the $3,000-$4,000 per book, depending on the artist you're working with and the quality. Because some of the artists will do the inking, the pencils, the inking, and the colors in one go, if you can find an indie artist that's a little bit cheaper, but still has the quality. But still, that's for a 24, 22 page book. That's a lot of investment for something that's so small. And then potentially you go onto Kickstarter or Indiegogo and you try and raise funds to recoup the money, but you already are starting from $3,000 or $4,000 behind before you even start making any money. So it's not easy to, you know, it's not a big money spinner off the bat. It's a long game that you have to sort of play with the comics.
And yeah, I would imagine, like, I don't know if you do like sort of like paperback or hard copies as well as just the digital sort of format. Because it's one of those things back in the day, like you could like wander in and pick up a comic and go, oh, this looks interesting. And with the sort of initial sales into a comic store, that could sort of finance that, where it's more digital these days, you know?
It's you kind of use both. So you always release everything as digital because there's postage issues and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of people now prefer to read just digitally. So for those people, you always offer it digital. Digital is fantastic for us creators because there's no additional cost for us. We don't have to post anything out. We don't have to print anything. So the more digital copies we can sell, absolutely the better. In terms of what we produce, though, so that's an idea of one of the ones that I've got running at the moment. And it's, you know, your typical sort of, full color, you know, all that sort of stuff. Awesome one on the background of there. So yeah, what you do is you either go through a publisher or you publish yourself, or you go on Kickstarter, run a campaign. And as part of that campaign, you have a print run and you print certain number of copies and you add in extra stuff and make it, you know, a bit more enjoyable for backers. So they feel like they're part of the whole process. And, you know, so it's a whole industry for indies to create this stuff. You're basically a writer, a publisher, a promoter, marketing person. You do everything yourself, and you're basically a small business owner to try and promote the stuff. It's a big lot of hats to wear.
I can imagine. Like, one of the things which I often comes to my mind when, like, I meet anyone who's been, okay, I'm starting my own business, I'm getting into the realm of just getting out there and, like, yeah, seeing what I can do. What was the sort of surprise, what came out of it? Because everyone has a sort of preconception of this is what it's going to be like. But then there's this thing which comes out of nowhere and you're like going, oh, damn, where did you come from?
It's probably two things. The first thing is definitely the cost. The cost really snuck up on me when I first started working here, and I'd run a music business for a while prior to doing this, so I understood about supply and demand and all that sort of stuff and stock, and but it's a very different thing when you've got to manage three or four people in a build process, and then you've got to, you know, manage your income and output and all that sort of stuff when the cost is a lot bigger than what I'm used to with my other business and that sort of thing. A lot bigger per item, if I can put it that way. It's just a much larger investment for something that's fairly small.
Yeah.
Whereas that same investment in the music business that I run, I can get a lot of product produced for that. So to give an idea, some of the music loops that I produce that other producers use, so I kind of work with them and they buy them and use them for their own stuff. For one large comic, that would give me probably half a year's worth of material to sell in the music business. So it would be that kind of, it's like a half year investment for something that's just one book.
Oh,
so that was That was one big thing, that the investment up front was really big. The other thing was, which is, so I've come from a novel writing background initially. That's where I started and then moved to comics. So I'm used to the idea of you have to find an audience. And with comics, it really struck me. It's a niche group of you know, already a small, relatively small group, and it's a niche group within there. And then within that, there's niches that you have to target. So it was a real eye opener of how do I find these people, and what things do they want that someone that's reading novels doesn't want, or they want different sort of things. So that was a real eye opener that they're just different. They have different wants and needs. And the other, okay, three things. So the other thing that really took me by surprise, which I was not prepared for at all, collecting, which makes sense to anyone with a brain, but I completely did not understand at all. Hang on. A lot of people are buying these not just to read, but they're buying them as a collector item, which completely changes the whole story of what you're doing and what sort of covers you put on the books, how you promote them, how you sell them together. They have sort of you can have the version that has, so like that version with the, you know, the text at the front and all that sort of stuff in there. Then you have a cover that's what they call a virgin cover. So there's no text on there, and they're all different. And some people will want all of them. Some people will want only certain types. Some people are drawn to certain artwork and not. So again, that was a whole new thing that I'd never, you just don't get that really in the novel world. It's very different. Yeah.
Yeah, no, because like, as I mentioned earlier, like, yes, I was introduced to comics in the 90s, and like the comics in the 90s, and this was spurred on by Batman 1989, which basically that made the comics market just go a little bit insane with regards to sort of collectibles. But like, this is the thing, like your big boys, such as your Marvel and your DC, and then Image, which came out of that in the sort of midnight, like, well, early 90s, like they started to produce shitloads of comic book covers for the collector's market because it was super inflated. And like, it was like, these comics are going to the moon. Like, strangely enough, the world we live in right now with NFTs, these things are going to the moon. It's like, wow. It just cycle after cycle, and here we are back again. You could hold it, you can store it, you could put in a plastic envelope back in the day. Now, today, you've just got to rely on some digital wallet and pray to God you do not get hacked. Or someone just gets your NFT, copies it, reverses it, and mints it again. It's a new NFT. But that's another story. But but with the collectible market, by all means, because I looked at Shadow's Daughter. When you picked it up, and on the back cover, you had her there. I was like, that would make a great poster. Where's the poster? You know what I mean? There is a whole range of things you can get into. So collectibles, how could you not? It's one of those things. I go, how could you miss that? But, you know,
I just, like I said, I was never involved. I've never collected toys, or I'm not a collector. Even the comics that I've got behind me, I get to a certain point where I think if I've read it and it's not something I would read again, I would like to get rid of it. But there are classics that I keep, but I'm just not a collector myself. So it didn't click. Then I started getting involved in the industry, and I realized, wow, I've underestimated this whole thing. It's another industry in itself. So now I've got to cater to that. But frankly, I'm a writer, so my interest is write stories, get people reading them, get people engaging. That's the key thing. So the collectibles is sort of a subset of that. So I'm not primarily doing what I'm doing for that. But it's part of it, because some of the fans, they will want that, and they'll want different covers, and they'll want, you know, t-shirts and stickers and posters and all that sort of stuff, original artwork. The last campaign that I did, you have what's called drawn in options, where people can pay a premium and then they get drawn into the comic as a character, so they can get, you know, killed off as a character, or they can be a hero or a villain or something like that. Which is, again, fairly unique to this medium, which is, again, another cool thing about comics.
Yeah, you know what? Like, this is the thing. Like, I have to ask this because, look, Okay, you're not like, okay, you come around to this, around the houses, music to novelists to like comic books. So what was the thing? What was that like epiphanal moment which made you like fall in love with this genre?
Excellent question, by the way. And I have an answer for this one. So the I was a struggling novelist with a day job, obviously, trying to get novels out there, trying to get a literary agent, trying to get a big publisher, which is a pathway to misery for anyone that's ever tried to do that. It is just a hard graft and very few people are successful. The whole myth of an overnight success is very damaging and not at all accurate. Anyway, so 10 years of this process, I'd written 6 or 7 books. I'd honed my craft and all that sort of stuff as much as I could within that period. Then I walk in, never been involved in comics. I walk into a comic shop in Brisbane. And I saw the image line and I saw Chew was the first comic book that I picked up and started flicking through, which is a really, really cool series, beautiful artwork, kind of funny, quirky. And I'm flicking through this thing and so I've always been a fan of film. And when I write more thinking of film influences than anything else. So I'm reading this thing and thinking this is like a film in book form. And I know the comic book purists will hate that, but it just struck me that, first of all, any story is up for grabs. It doesn't matter what it is, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, you know, anything can be done this way and can be done really well. You have the immediacy of a page that you turn, which means you can visually shock someone when you turn the page, which is not, it's something you can do with a novel, but it's not the same as you turn over and there's a splash page with something incredible happening on it. So you have the visual as well as the words and the story and all that sort of stuff. So the epiphany was the thing that I've been desperately trying to do. And the ultimate goal is get, you know, a lot of books out there and then get them turned into TV or film, or, you know, that's a goal for a lot of us because we want to see the thing visually represented. And I thought comic books are a shortcut to me seeing my stuff, you know, represented in that, almost in that that medium. So it's just a little step away from having it in film, but I thought rather naively, but it'll be cheaper and quicker all the rest of that. I mean, it kind of is, but it isn't in some ways. But that was the immediate appeal. So literally the week that I discovered comics, I lost all my money and bought every comic I could find, started educating myself in all of the, you know, the classic comics that are around and all that sort of stuff. But I immediately started translating novels into comic scripts and trying to figure out how to do it and all that sort of stuff. Because of that, the appeal of I can do something visual and with the story and, you know. Yeah. And since then, I still write, still do novels, still do graphic novels now, comics, and then sometimes a blend of, you know, short stories with artwork and those sorts of things. But the comics was a real revelation of what you could do, what was possible. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious, like, because with regards to the realm of doing a novel and, like, yes, the surprises of, like, difference between comics and novels. Like, do you find when you're writing for your comics, you have to have in mind what it might look like in a panel? Because you don't have to do that. You just, like, person can rely on their imagination from a novel, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, you do. You have to, I do anyway. The other thing is different creators do it differently and they write scripts different ways and all that sort of stuff. I think in terms of film largely, so I'll think scene by scene and every page will be one or two or three scenes of what's happening and who's doing what to who, what action is happening, what's the key thing. One of the peculiarities about the way that I work is I'll get the script done very quickly and it will be ready to go, but it won't be perfect because I want the artist to present what they're doing. And invariably it's going to be different to what I'd imagine. So I'll roughly put ideas of what this person looks like and all that sort of stuff. But when I get the image back, it will be different to what I'd imagine. And you know, invariably better. It's usually better than what I can imagine because these guys are artists. That's what they do. Then once I've got that, I'll put all the lettering in. And as I'm writing the, putting the lettering in, I'll be changing the dialogue because, well, their expression is different there to what I'm imagining. And it makes more sense for them to say something punchier here or to say something lighter or a bit more. So you actually change as you're going along, or I do anyway, which makes it more of a back and forth with the artist. And it gives you, you've got to be on your toes because obviously you're changing it on the go and it's still got to be cohesive and all of the rest of it. But it gives us this sense of I'm writing to the images rather than I'm writing and telling them, do this thing. The other thing, I've mentioned this a few times on a few different places, but I discovered last year I have this thing called aphantasia, which is they've only recently named it. It's basically there are a small percentage of people that if they have no visual imagination. So if I close my eyes and try and imagine a bike, for instance, or a guitar,
yeah,
I see darkness. I don't see anything at all. And I've been like that since birth. And I'd thought when people are saying, oh, imagine a house with a blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I thought they were being figurative. I thought everyone in the world was being figurative when they said imagine, because of course, when you close your eyes, you can't imagine anything. It's just black. There's just nothing there. Then I realized, no. The rest of the world can see stuff in their head. You can't. Yeah. So yeah, there's about 2% of the population that have this thing. Yeah.
Okay. Like, And you decided to become a novelist and a comic book writer. What? Is that you? What the?
Well,
what?
So apparently, I don't know what the stats are, but apparently, you know, Pixar, the company that does all the Pixar movies and lots of stuff, apparently a large percentage of people that work there have aphantasia. So they have this. Now, I don't know if they're the artists or the, you know, money people, finance people or whatever. But I know that company, a lot of people have it apparently. But there are artists I've spoken to that have it as well. Yeah, it's weird.
All I've got to say is it's never the finance people. They can imagine huge piles of money. And if you mess that sort of like imaginary block, and quite annoyed quite quickly.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But yeah, I think that's why I work this way, where I'll have an idea, I'll write it all down, but I wait to see what the artist comes back with, because that will give me the material to really hone in on the story, because I can't imagine it. Even the example I give is my mother passed 4 years ago or thereabouts. I can't remember her face. I cannot close my eyes and visualize what my mother looks like, or my father who's still alive, or my wife or my child. It's such a strange thing that as soon as you close your eyes, everything is blank. So the question I've asked myself in the last, you know, year or so, and other people have asked as well, is how the hell can you write these sorts of things? Surely you have to imagine them. So how do you imagine them? And the way I've described it is, which doesn't make any sense at all, but the way I've described it is, it's like in your imagination, there's a black sheet that you can't see through. And behind that sheet, there are actors acting out something. So you still know what's going on somehow, but you can't see any of it, which again, doesn't make any sense, but that's the only way I can think to describe it, because I still dream. I still imagine things. I think through scenes, but none of it is visual in a normal sense. So it's almost like I'm locked off from that part of my brain.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because,
very strange.
Yeah, no, like, I do find it strange, because, like, this is the thing. When you're doing a comic book and, like, okay, how can I put it? Yes, you're building the world this character lives in. And then as time goes on and with, like, new characters coming in, if they become popular and everything like this, they sort of spring off and become something of their own entity. And that sort of world starts to get bigger, and then another person, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So to say you don't have any sort of like mental visualization of how that sort of comes down in your imagination, it's like do you kind of miss bits, or do certain things don't make any sense when you bring some comics together and go, okay, right, I've got Shadow's daughter, and I've got another character, and like, yeah, they met at this point, and now they've been doing their little thing, and now they're back together. How does that work?
Well, this is the thing. So you would think so. So I'll give you an example. So there's a book series that only the first one is out. So it's called Whiplash. Mm-hmm. It's actually a book. So it's a novel. It looks like a graphic novel, but it's not a graphic novel yet. There's four books in the series. More are coming out this year, but so far only one is out. There's that. There's this one here, which is a graphic novel, which is kind of a like Hellboy style artwork. Really cool artist did that one. There's three side novels. There's a book of short stories, and they're all related to the same world. So they're all related to this world of this imaginary city called Rust, which is a city that sits within the dream world. The rest of the world of dreams is kind of in flux, and it comes and goes and all the rest of that. But this one city is sort of permanent, a permanent fixture. Mm-hmm. And the stories are all about people that are drawn into this city. It's a city that's caught in rebellion, ruled over by a tyrant. There's this whole thing, but it's all around that. So I've got all of these different characters, different stories, different timelines. They all relate to this one city. And it's really weird because I can see it so clearly, but I can't actually see any of it. So I can understand it, and I can feel what the character, I can, you know, tell you the different plots of all the different stories and the characters and everything, but I can't see any of it. And I mean, I have a spreadsheet filled with information so I don't, you know, accidentally kill someone that wasn't alive or any of that sort of stuff as things go on. But I cannot explain. I mean, to the point where my wife didn't believe me when I first said, I think I've got this thing, because how can you have that? But another good example is, this is why whenever we're looking at house renovations or anything like that, we always argue, because I cannot understand what she's saying, because I can't see it, where she can see the whole thing. Uh-huh. We're going to knock out this wall, and we're going to put a thing here and a thing there. And I'm thinking, I don't know what that looks like. Yeah. Anyway.
So it's kind of like you see the scaffolding, but you don't actually see the details of everything. You understand the scaffolding of it going here and there, and this is how it's gonna, like, will support that. But you can't see the actual details where everything, what it will look like when you remove that scaffolding to make the actual building or to make that actual world.
Well, yeah, and maybe faces is the best way to explain it. So I mean, maybe other novelists do this as well, but I have to have a visual image and a clear description of a face of a character that I'm working on, because I forget, because I can't keep them in my head. So I'll get to them, and it'll get to a description about their eye color, and I have to go back and check what was their eye color, and not just because there's so many characters, but more because I just cannot remember. I can't remember what style of hair they have. I can't remember any of the details other than the name and, you know, the rest of their character. So again, I don't know whether other writers have to have that as well, but I really have to rely on that. So sometimes I'll find a free image online of just some random model or something, because they look kind of like what I think that character could look like. And then I'll just save that image and keep going back to it every time I need to describe them, because I can't keep it in my mind. And sometimes that this is why editors are great, because sometimes that will bring me up and they'll say, well, hang on, you said they have blue eyes and now they have brown eyes and then they have hazel eyes. Are their eyes changing? And then I'll either say, no, just fix it. Or I'll say, oh yeah, they're changing because there's some sort of demonic possession going on that you don't know about yet. It's in book three. I haven't written it yet. Yeah, that does happen quite a bit, I must say.
Yeah, because like, wow. Look, just from how you mention it, you've got a hell of a lot of things like plates spinning. I think you mentioned about 8 or 9 things you've like got on the go. And do you have someone else writing with you, or are you just doing all the writing yourself?
I'm doing all the writing myself. I've written for other people, but at the moment, the Shadow's Daughter novel, I've actually, part of the Kickstarter that I ran, I opened it up and I said, you know, if you can help me with some of the artwork, you can be a co-writer on an issue. We'll do an issue together. Mm-hmm. It's good for you because you get, you know, exposure and all that. It's good for me because I can rely on you and we can work together. So this will be the first time I'll be working with three different other writers on the project. But at the moment, everything is come from me. And I mean, look, honestly, you'll find this with most writers, particularly in novelists. They produce a lot of indie people. They tend to just get a lot because that's how you get out there and you get known, and you know, so you've got to always be writing. The benefit from my side is comics. I can write 5 comics at the same time because I just need the money to pay for 5 different artists to start at the same time. The actual script writing doesn't take me long. So I can write 5 scripts in the time that it would take. Give me 5 days and I'll write 5 scripts. No worries. So the actual writing side is not the bit that takes the time. It's once the artwork comes back and then working with the artist and the lettering and all that sort of stuff. So it means I can produce a lot more, a lot quicker than if I was just doing novels, then it would be, you know, it takes a lot longer to do that. Yeah, so you kind of share it out a bit. But also, I mean, I've been doing this for a while. It's just that not a lot of the stuff has been released yet. It's only just now starting to get released. So one of my publishers, Marcosia, is starting to release stuff now. So I think we've got four comics, graphic novel, and 1 book. And that will probably double or triple by the end of the year. Just because they're in the pipeline, it just takes a while for them to get through and get out there. And then another 9 or 10 comics this year, and we'll see how we go. Maybe another novel in there as well. Yeah, but it's very common. Writers are like this, that they write and write and write because it's a possession thing. You know how we have this inner demon or whatever it is, that the voice in the back of your head that's saying you're not good enough. My voice doesn't say what you've done isn't good enough quality. I know it's not good enough for me. I know nothing I produce is going to meet my level of what I would expect. My voice says you need to produce, you need to finish this, you need to get it out, you need to do more, you're not doing enough. So you kind of harness that, which means I'm very, very productive, but I don't have that same, it's that whole progress, not perfection thing. Everything doesn't need to be perfect when it leaves me. It just needs to be good enough that I look at it and think, I would buy this. I like it. I think it's great. That's good enough. Because then I've got to quickly get that done because the next thing's coming. So it's a bit of, you know, we all have our issues. That's one of my issues.
Yeah, I think that's where people miss the mark at times. Like because they aim for perfection, and perfection in my, like, because it doesn't exist, leads to procrastination. Like, and with procrastination, that kills more or less everyone's dreams, whatever it might be. And like, what it should be is like, it should, like, it's not just a case of being good enough. It's like good enough plus one. So it's like, you know, like, because when someone goes, oh, it's good enough, you go, yeah, that's a pile of dog shit. Like, So getting it out there is like, yeah, good enough plus one. And the plus one is the thing what makes the difference. Like, I was watching, what was it called? I was watching 2 episodes of this show on Netflix. Africa's Knockout Show. And like, it's like this reality show, right? Where how can I say, like The Contender. I haven't watched an episode of The Contender, but I've watched a number of reality, like, sort of game shows. Now, this is all filmed in Nigeria. The production film values, like graphics, which transition and everything like that, perfectly fine. And you're like, you go, okay. But I was like, sitting there watching it, I was like going, what are you missing? It's like, I was like, as you watched it, it was like, where is this, like, the background stories of, I've come from this, and like, basically the little bits of music which would have added that. Little plus ones which come here, there, and everywhere to sort of differentiate it from any other show. And it was just like, I only could do it for 2 episodes because it was like, guys, like, your storytelling for that sort of the extra little bits suck. Yeah. Everything else about the show is perfectly fine. You could like drop it anywhere else, but that element of it just took you away from it. And it was like, I don't care anymore. I've watched two episodes. I don't care. And like, yeah, like,
yeah, it's very common. And it, and with comics, there's a bit of a saying, I don't know if it's a saying, but I think it's a Japanese saying, the first bite is with the eye. The whole thing, you know, the first thing you do with food is you see it, and that it's got to be appealing and all that. So they will, people will buy a comic based on the look of the artwork because that's the first thing that they see. But if your story is terrible, they will never buy another issue of that, and you've lost them. You know, the thing that keeps people invested is the story. The story's got to be great, but the artwork is kind of the first thing. And I've read many comics, but there's one in particular which I will not name, by a very decent publisher. The artwork was gobsmacking. I purely bought this thing on the artwork. It was amazing. It was so good. And the story looked like this is going to be really good. And I read it, and I kid you not, it took me so long to get through this thing. It's only 124 pages. It's like a collected edition. It was so bad and so boring. And it's an action-packed thing, so it shouldn't be boring, but it was just, there was just nothing in there. And it kind of, one of those things where it had all the elements that should work, but it just didn't work. And I thought, well, that's it. I can't buy the next one of these because it's beautiful, but it's got no substance. It's not giving me a reason to want to invest in this thing. Yeah.
I hear you. Now, I have to say, look, you've mentioned Kickstarter and raising those funds a couple of times, and you've been very impressive. Got 168 backers and managed to raise $9,500 to say the least, when your target was $1,000. That is a highly successful campaign. How did you get that to work for you? You know what I mean?
It's a lot of work. So that's my fourth campaign, I think. It's one of these things that I'll give you an example. That's my fourth campaign. I did a huge amount of work on it, worked with backers when they came in. I gave away four. I did a special thing where four backers would win a theme song, their own theme song. So I would write their own theme song and they get that, and it's theirs and it's unique, and it's, no one else was offering that. The people loved it. They thought it was great, you know, and I had great fun doing it. And it's something I can do. I've got all the equipment. It's what I do every other day anyway. So for me, it wasn't a big thing, but it gave a lot of joy to people. I gave away two T-shirts. I gave away, as the money crept up and the more backers came in, I gave away four additional digital comics in the same series. So so anyone that backed it got the six initial print comics and then another four comics in the same series. So they get a massive amount of this, you know, sort of stuff. So a lot of value, a lot of worth. I was producing videos and doing all sorts of funny stuff, keeping them engaged, keeping things fun and happy and all that. So it's almost like, it's like you're putting on a show, or you're inviting them into a tent and you're like, okay, come into the festival and let's have some fun. There's a lot of that. So that's a lot of work. So just shy of 10,000. I'll tell you now, that doesn't cover the artwork at all. So it doesn't cover the artwork because it has to cover the printing and the postage costs. So you kind of halve the amount from there. There is a portion of people that back at the time, but you don't actually get the money because they, for whatever reason, you know, that they can't pay the, you know, it's not like buying at a shop. It's a bit different. So there's a bit of that as well. And the artwork and everything else and the promotion and the giveaways, so that's what I'm saying. It's a long game. So it looks amazing. And it's by far my most successful campaign, and it was great. And I'm going to be doing another one in another. Okay. So I've got another one running on Indiegogo, which is the same campaign, but for anyone that missed it. And then I'll do another one coming up in a few months. So it's a great way to meet new people and all that sort of stuff. But it's a hard slog. It's a lot of effort. You've got to be smart, and you've got to offer people something that they genuinely want that they won't get anywhere else. To give you an idea, so that's my story and kind of what I'm doing, and you know, lots of stuff. Brendan Sanderson, very like probably the biggest fantasy author name in the world. He's written, you know, a lot of books, amazing books. I won't go through them all, but anyway, he's an amazing writer. He's very well known. He's been writing since the 80s, I think, or 90s. So he's a big name in fantasy. He goes on to Kickstarter. I don't know how many millions he raised, but it was many, many millions. It was hundreds of thousands of backers, and I was one of them. So he essentially sets up his own publishing empire in one go by coming into Kickstarter and saying, so it's one of those things that if you already have a name and you have the audience, you can just set yourself up independently and go, right, I'm just going to do this myself. If you don't have a name and you don't have an audience, it's a bit of a grind to slowly build and build and build. And you've got to build confidence with people. And then once they know, hey, I've backed two of these campaigns from this guy, he's got the goods, the stuff is great, he always comes through, then that it starts to sort of grow from there. But yeah, it's a really interesting one. There was a comic book called Berserk, which Keanu Reeves was involved with.
Okay.
And that did huge amounts of money. And everyone's going, see this amazing comic book. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's got Keanu Reeves in it. I mean, you're going to get a ton of interest because it's got Keanu Reeves in it. If he comes over and appears in one of my books, it would be amazing. You know, you're going to get hundreds of thousands of people interested. So it's a really interesting one. But it's also, there's three reasons to do a Kickstarter if you're a comic creator or indie creator. One is obviously to get some money. So even though it doesn't cover all the costs, it covers enough that if I do a few of these, you eventually will get to the point where you're at least breaking even or potentially getting ahead. So in the long run, it makes up. The other thing is, I'm in Australia, I'm in Brisbane. I can't go to Comic-Con in New York, I could, but talk about losing all the money and, you know, flights and accommodation and all that sort of stuff.
It'll cost.
So yeah, exactly. So this way I can meet people from all around the world that, you know, most of my backers aren't in Australia. Most of them are, you know, in the UK or America or, you know, wherever else, Canada, Netherlands as well. So it's a great way to meet those people. And it's a great way to market and get your face out there and get your stuff out there. So it kind of hits all of those three. But it's like running your own show. So you really have to put the effort in. And there are a lot of people that will put their book on there and they won't do any of the other stuff. They won't contact people when they back them and say, hey, thanks so much for backing. Great to have you part of it, all that sort of stuff. They won't offer freebies or additional things or stretch goals or any of that sort of stuff. And it's such a missed opportunity because the feedback I got from this last campaign, four or five people commented and said, you can tell basically, all right, I've got a fan for life with these guys. If I treat them right, everything that I run, they're going to back and they're going to get involved in. And they'll, because they know they like my stuff. They like the way I write. They like the way I think. They love the artwork. So it's such a good opportunity. Whereas when you're an indie novelist or you're doing indie sort of stuff, a lot of time you don't meet people that have read your stuff. You don't get a lot of feedback. You don't interact with fans. So you don't know, is anyone even reading this? Do they even care? Is it occasionally you'll get reviews come through on, you know, Amazon or Goodreads or something like that. But you feel so far removed. Whereas these campaigns are a great way to get right up in front of people and talk to them and ask them questions and meet them. It's like a Comic-Con, but like a small online version of it. So really, I highly recommend it, but you've got to do a lot of work to make it work for you. Yeah.
I also think it's one, like with regards to the medium, like of comics, I think it's one of those things where people get a lot more personally invested over a novel. Like people like, what about Harry Potter? Harry Potter, if you look at the first Harry Potter book, it was quite a slender thing. You might say it's about maybe 10 comics pasted together and away you go. And I think I've never read a Harry Potter book. And like, this is the thing, I might read a Harry Potter book in the future, but yeah, the early stuff. And it was when it was saying, and then as time went by, the books got thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker because the people initially who started reading it were kids who, like, yeah, it was the way I've heard it being talked about. The chapters are easy to read. They're quite quick and they're quite snappy, pretty much like a comic book. Yeah. And so people can invest in it. But my point is, comic books, each and every single, like, depending how you do it, if it's a weekly thing, like bi-weekly, or typically a monthly thing, I think, well, back in the day when I used to buy it, was a monthly thing. Yes, you got your comic, you got your sort of like, right, and you get invested quite quickly. Okay, what's the next thing? What's going to happen? And if you've, like, they've done the complete run, you get the graphic novel and you get all the books together and you just go with it. With that sense of community, it, like, when you've got them on the hook, you don't need that many people to sort of like, yeah, just keep like producing stuff. If you've got 1,000 people, like, you know what I mean? 1,000 true fans. I can never remember the name of the author what says this, but that's like $100,000 a year you can like have coming in, which is more than enough to produce quite a lot of the stuff you want to produce. And like, because you're producing comics, most probably like, yeah, collectibles, like t-shirts, posters, that is a very sort of powerful IP, if you get around.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And that's what one of the things that I think younger creators or any creator struggles with, and I've struggled with this my whole adult life as well, is you have a dream and you have a thing that you want to do, and ultimately you want someone to pay you to do the thing you love. And, you know, I want to write and I want to create and I want to do that and I want someone to pay for me. But it's very hard to get into a circumstance where that's happening. So most of us have to have day jobs and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And there's this thing that it's kind of all in or nothing. So you have to do it all or you know, it's not going to work. And what I had to really come to terms with is what is my measure of success? What does that mean for me that I'm doing okay, that I've made it and everything? Is it that I write full time? Is it that I'm with a massive publisher and I'm one of five people that are at the Harry Potter level or not even at that, you know? Where will I get to that I'll be content, that I'm happy to go at this? And I've realized that it's exactly that point, because of the modern world that we live in and we're all interconnected and everything. You need a fan base, and that fan base doesn't need to be massive. It just needs to be passionate, and it needs to be big enough that they will support what you're doing and they're interested. And it's enough that you can do the thing you love. That's it. And I think that's a great goal to go for, instead of, you know, I need millions of dollars and I need to be, you know, everyone needs to know my name and all that sort of stuff. It's just, you just need that community. That's what you need. Yeah.
No, I agree. Community is the power behind it all. The community is the driving engine of it all, and without it, you kind of like fall by the wayside. And like, this is the thing, like, and like, when I look at the sort of comic world, look, I'm a child of the 70s and 80s, and like, look, sort of fantasy comic books and everything like that, comic book stuff, were like, I loved it, but in this, like, in the 70s and 80s, let's just say, oh, even in the 90s, there was a lot of bad stuff out there. Like, from like watching like, oh, the like Spider-Man TV show. Wow. Look at that. You're like, oh, I sat down and I watched this with a smile on my face. How high was I? was I just high on endorphins and sugar?
There was nothing else. There was nowhere else you could go. That was it. That was what we had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like watching The Incredible Hulk, where, you know what I mean? It's like, okay. Oh, we need a big guy painted green. None of this, like, okay, CGI thing. It was like, okay, yeah. You know, going, and each week, it's like, you're like, it's so sad. Why can't you just find a place where you can stay and have friends? It's like, yeah. off he goes.
And the pants that when he hulks out, and the pants, you can see the scissor marks where they've cut it. They don't even look ripped. They're just scissored.
Well, they didn't have money to rip jeans. it's like, right. Yeah. Oh, look, the Hulk. Okay. Yes. Each week, like, the most aggressive thing he fought was a bear. Yeah. And it wasn't like this was a sophisticated bear. It was like, okay, look.
Just a bear. Yeah.
And then then you had Linda Carter as Wonder Woman. I say no more.
I remember. Yeah. But then you have, okay, question number one, the invisible jet, does it have a toilet? And if it does, when you...
No.
Like, is anything visible? No. Okay. There are questions. I still have questions about how that whole thing works. You know, just...
Let's just like be like, okay, Wonder Woman doesn't poop.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
She doesn't. And she doesn't have any visitors that need to on that plane. That's an out. That's not no deal. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
You put on that superhero costume, it takes care of itself. Could you imagine? Like, that's something where Superman, he's super strong, right? Yeah. So I'll hate to see what happens to whatever toilet he gets. That's like, time to have a, what's it made out
he's
of?
Got
it?
He needs a new one. He needs a new one every day. Yeah. All the cracked ones are just off in the side in the farm somewhere, and he's going to have a new one every day.
So many cracked toilets. Man. So many toilets lost their lives at the hands of Superman. But, like, this is the thing with, like, all of the superhero content, which, like, from the oh-so-terrible to the oh-so-good, and now for the last sort of 17 years, we've entered into this wonderful golden age of just like, oh my God, spoiled choice. Like, from, okay, your classic, MCUs and like Disney, like, your DC comics, which I don't know how DC have fucked the pooch so bad. Like, basically, like, if you look at the animated stuff, like from the 90s up until present day, it's wonderful. But, they can't do a like cinematic movie to save their lives when it comes to bringing the Justice League together. Batman, yes, they can do that, but they've beaten Batman to death with regards to how many times they're bringing it out. And this is where I'm coming to. Much of the comic book IP, which is out there right now, has been rehashed, recycled, and reused beyond belief. It's when you get something refreshing, like your Umbrella Academies, basically The Boys, one other, like, even that Utopian show, which came on like Netflix for a season and like basically died to death. Like,
but that's a UK, originally in the UK, and the UK version was amazing. It was so much better. Anyway, but comic books, all from comic books.
Yeah. And like, this is the thing. I get somewhat concerned because, okay, yes, there's like the superhero genre is mighty and strong. But like, this is the thing. If it carries on like this and they keep rehashing it, and like, look, I love the latest Spider-Man movie. I was like, oh, bravo. But done that story so many times. It's like, look, Uncle Ben, he's dead again. Oh, right. This time you've killed Aunt May. I'm sorry. Spoiler alert. It's like, you know what I mean? But it's been done so many times. I feel like there's a danger where comic book movies and the superhero genre might go the way of the Western in the realms of movie and television. Because the standard and the quality is not as high as it once was, and it is declining slowly but surely from what I've seen.
Well, I mean, it's difficult to think of another. Westerns is probably a good one. It's difficult to think of another genre where there have been so many films and reboots and of this, essentially the same characters. And I mean, the same thing has happened in the comic world. There's been so many iterations of those characters, many, many iterations, but in film as well, it's very hard. And it's, this was one of the things that attracted me to indie comics was I'm not invested in Spider-Man or Superman or Batman or any of the men. I didn't grow up. I mean, I grew up with that in film, but not in comics, but also I've seen so much of it. When I started writing, one of my rules was I'm never going to write a book about a vampire, because it was around that time that a certain series was coming in and a lot of stuff was happening. I did break that rule, incidentally, but that was for legitimate reasons. But you know what I mean?
Your vampires shiny?
They were not shiny. That's always puzzled me. There's this, I suppose, since the Anne Rice thing, there's always this idea of vampires being sexy and being these, I mean, they're essentially blood sucking leeches that are dead, but not quite dead enough. So my version, they're far more despicable kind of creatures. And I think, but anyway, that's taking it aside. But yeah, the thing I like about indie comics is that anything is open. And I think there are so many more interesting ideas to explore and new type of, and even in the superhero genre, there's so many new and interesting things to approach. So an example, and again, I don't want to blow my own horn, but let's. So I wrote one of the comics that I've written. There's three comics in the series. It's called Idle Thuggery. And the idea is focuses on a henchman for a supervillain. So it's a superhero story, but from the perspective of this guy that just gets caught up in this superhero world. But he is just a henchman who sees everyone above him just get destroyed. Because if you're a henchman for an arch villain, your lifespan is about 2 weeks. You're not going to hang around very long. So it's this whole idea of, you know, approach it from a different angle and all of that sort of stuff, because it's been done so much. There has to be a different angle. There has to be something. And I mean, I love Batman. I love the movies. I love that whole sort of thing. But are we at the point where it's kind of, we're just going for money, we're not going for story? Like, is it just we know that a certain number of people are always going to watch this because they're fans, so we're going to go with another reboot of Batman or another, you know, Spider-Man or Superman or whatever the case may be? Surely there's a different way. Don't even get me started with Star Wars and Disney and I mean, how many more? Anyway, I won't get started. That's the whole thing.
You know what? Hey, can get started because, like, look, quite simply, look, okay, in the Star Wars universe, right? Like, it's a huge universe, trillions of life forms which go around doing their thing, but yet it all comes down to one freaking family. Well, two families every single time. You know, so I go, you know, I go, really?
The war? Are they that important?
Yeah. Yes, I go, look, take them all out. They're just like, they're a pain in the backside right now. Just get rid of them all. You know, I go, come on. It's like, there has to be other stories you can tell. And like, you know, well, thankfully, like the sort of Mandalorian has taken it to a certain way.
Yeah.
And like, this is the thing. If you look at Star Wars Rogue One, I would say that was quite a refreshing like film out of the whole Star Wars thing. Where it's like, you can do it, but why are you not doing it? And when you hear about the sort of shambles which came out of the whole Star Wars thing, it's like, what direction is this going in? We have no idea, because none of the writers knew, none of the actors knew. And I think it didn't have a strong voice like in the original Star Wars film, like Alex Guinness, who just went like, going, what is this shit you're giving me? It's like, going, and he rewrit parts of the film and went, no, I'm paid, but I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to tarnish my legacy with a crock of shit. Let me just, I'll write this, I'll write that. It's like, and George Lucas was like, thank you very much. Thank you. Because George Lucas, he is not a writer. He creates stuff, but he is not a writer. He's a concept guy. He is not a writer. Let me say that again. He's not, right? It's like, all the prequels, like, yeah, like all the prequels, like Kingdom, like Indiana Jones, the Crystal Skull. Yeah. No.
Yeah, and there's this, I think when you, the thing I like about what Netflix has done and other platforms are doing now is it's possible to have a creator that has a kind of singular vision for the thing that they've built. They know end to end what this thing is going to look like.
Mm.
And Netflix will say, all right, go and make the thing the way you want to make it with your vision, and we'll support, and we'll, sure, there's going to be notes and those sorts of things happening, but you can kind of see, you can tell when someone has been allowed to put this thing together end to end, because it just has that feel to it, and you get this consistency throughout, and that it's fresh and it's new. And whereas you have something the size and scope of Star Wars and so many fans and so many iterations and all that sort of stuff, it must be very, very hard to come into that and have that same vision and that same kind of, you know, it's almost like, I suppose you've kind of got to say, well, just damn everyone else. I'm going to do a slice of this world, and my slice is going to look like this, you know, hence the Mandalorian thing maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, I think as soon as you step away from that singular vision, not to say it should be just one person, because I think you get a lot of benefit with other creative people coming in and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, there's definitely, you can tell when something, when there's 15 people in a room deciding the plot of where something's going to go, it just loses that focus. Star Wars.
Yeah, no, like this is the thing. I think sometimes when it comes to like much of the like intellectual property out there, the storytelling has taken a sort of second seat to the ideology telling of like whatever ideology that person who is leading that creative team, rather than sort of like going, okay, put your own like sort of either whatever political views or how you want the world to look, and concentrate on the story. And like the whole thing is, I think it's become clear with, I'm going to say, much of Hollywood, that it's the ideology has taken the much more of the like control over the real story, because most of the stories which people are sort of gravitating to are stuff which are, I would say, just sort of about 15 years out. I mentioned Invincible, that they've updated some of it, but that sort of stems from about 10 years ago, if I remember rightly. And lot of the stuff which is being popularized right now, more sort of your sort of manga scene and everything like that, which is coming from like, yeah, Japan and stuff like this. And like, got some of the manga scene in the States, but they concentrate more on the story rather than sort of like, hey, let's just go with, yes, the like, this is the ideal, this is our ideological view, and this is what this should be in the context of these characters, and which you go, that I'm not too sure is going to work. It, like, you know what I mean? It's like, if the story should be there, and if it's got a message, like if there's a message which you can attach to it, fine. But you don't use the ideological, like whatever ideological view you might have, to then just drive a story which it necessarily won't work, especially if you've had IP which has been around for a long time. And when I say IP, that's intellectual property, people.
That is a challenge with, and look, I've looked at things that I've written 10 years ago or further back, and thought, okay, if I was writing that now, would I be writing that differently? Would I have different characters and all that sort of stuff because of the changes that have come through and wanting to have better representation and all that sort of stuff? It's a hell of a lot easier for me because my stuff isn't big, so I can do whatever the hell I want with anything. Like you say, things that have already been around and have been established a certain way and have a fan base that have fallen in love with certain characters and certain, you know, to go through that and sort of take a clean sweep and change a lot of things to make them more palatable or more sensitive to the, you know, the concerns of the modern world. And I completely get the reasons why you would do that. But then you're, you know, what of the substance are you changing, and what are you going to, and then you're going to have the situation where I've got angry fans over here that like the original. Mm-hmm. I've got angry new fans over here that are saying it hasn't gone far enough to meet our current expectations. And then you're in the middle kind of trying to put a hand in both worlds, which is, and I think what you're losing is exactly what you're saying. But what's the story? What's the, and the thing is, the key thing that drives us to enjoy this sort of stuff, there's the fantastical worlds and there's all that sort of stuff. But the key thing that keeps us coming back is the struggle. We're not going to read a story about a fantastical world where nothing bad ever happens. We're drawn to conflict and problems that aren't easily solved, and people struggling through war and strife and issues, and whether it's personal or psychological or fantastical, whatever it might be. And those things are kind of universal. So I think you need to focus on those things. They're the things that draw us in as readers and viewers and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. The other stuff, to a large degree, I mean, I think you can change a lot of things without losing that, but it's when that stuff is changed and the key, like you said, the key focus is a preachy message or we want to correct a societal wrong. If that's not the core message of the story that you were telling, then it's kind of like, well, you're overlaying something over the top of it, which is probably going to dilute the essential message. So maybe find a story where that is the central message, if that's the thing that you want to really, you know, drive, because there's lots of stories out there.
Yeah.
But it is one of these things. It's a constant thing that you think of as a writer and a creator is because I don't want to write something that's marginalizing a whole bunch of people or that's being insensitive or that's, you know, whatever. And I'll lean on editors because I'll use a phrase that's, you know, oh, dude, that's like 20 years out of date. We don't say that anymore. Great. If you can pick that up for me now, I'd rather fix that than, you know, basically upset a whole bunch of readers for something that honestly I'm not aware that was a thing that, you know, we need to get right, and, you know, all the rest of it. It's a tricky one as well, because if it's this whole precision of language thing as well, about being precise with language and you know, and people getting offended because you've said, you know, something that's the wrong thing or all that sort of stuff. It's a hard one because I think it's something you've got to be conscious of as a writer. And then there's the whole, don't even get me started on the, do I have the right to write in the perspective of an African-American woman or someone from another culture? Or because I completely get that, you know, yeah, that's kind of, you're taking something away from them or you're assuming things or that's the thing. 100% get it. But then it's like, but I also write from a demon's perspective, and I write from an angel's perspective, and I write from, that's the creative process, is you're writing from someone else's head and you're making that stuff up, you know? So it's a complex one that fortunately I'm small enough in the industry that I haven't had to deal with that, but you do think about it for sure. Cause it's kind of what we're all working through.
Well, I'll say you're small enough at this present time, but hey, you know what? Hey, give it 5-10 years. Who knows? Like, I'm like, hey, wait a second. Shadow's Door on Netflix? All right. It's like, okay, great stuff. Because, like, yeah, I can see it going that way. Because, look, when you, like, look at Umbrella Academy, it was the guy from Chemical Romance. He did that and Umbrella Academy, I swear to God. Like, I might be wrong, please, someone can correct.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
not sure.
But yeah, he was like, yes, I'm going to do these comics. And it's like, yeah, great. And it's like, before you know it, it's like, it started out as a comic. And before you knew it, it moved into being a TV show. And here it is right now. Who knows where it might go in the future. So with regards to the future of what you're doing right now, where would you like it to go? Where would you like it to grow in a sense of things?
Yeah, so I ultimately, limited series on your Netflix sort of thing would be great. Even animated series would be amazing. For something like Shadow's Daughter, animated series, Whiplash, that sort of stuff, I think a live action series would be great. that's the ultimate goal of where I'd love to go to see that. But I'm under no illusions at it's very, very unlikely that deals go to that point. Like there's many, many things that get stopped before they get to the point of that's actually produced. I'm happy for them to grab one of my IP and just wreck it, just completely. Even if they got it and they put it through and they just get actors that are wrong and they change the direction and I don't get a say in it and the whole thing happens, even that would be fine, because then I can go, but you know what, the comic version or the novel version is that's the way that I envisioned it. And then, you know, another 10 years after that, they can do a reboot and it'll be closer to what, you know. So honestly, it's just the more the stories get out there, the more people read and interact. And the thing that gets me up in the morning is a comment from one person that has read a story that I've read and they come back and they say, this was amazing. I can't wait for the next one. Thank you so much. That's it. That'll keep me going for a year. Just that one comment. So that's the thing. So the more of that I can get in whatever format, whether it's graphic novels, comics, novels, film, TV, any of that sort of stuff, I'd love to get more involved in the film and TV side of things, as most of us would. But as long as I'm still able to create and write and people are reading, that would be great. And I don't really see an end in mind. I'm a bit of a workaholic with this sort of stuff. So I can see the Whiplash series is at book number 4. I can see that getting to about 10. I can see the Seven Hungers is a series that I've just started to release. I can see that getting to about maybe 7 or 8 books. The comics, I've got no idea when they're going to stop, maybe when the money runs out. Yeah. So honestly, it would be great to work with, you know, some bigger people in the industry, but it's the fans. The more people I can get to read, if I can get to that 1,000 mark, 1,000 solid people that love everything I produce or most of the things, and they will back me, that would be amazing.
Superb. Okay. Final question. Yeah. Now.
Yeah.
If there was a comic book you could write a story for, not your own, but like someone else, who would you like write for?
Oh man. Okay. So the guy that did, there's a few things. So Legion was a TV series that was on a little while ago. I loved the way that was done. So anything to do with that kind of world. Also, whoever came up with the it's a Douglas Adams book series about the detective agency. Oh, I cannot remember the name of it. But anyway, Netflix did a version of that, which was just bananas, weird, crazy. I loved that series so much. Dirk Gently's something.
I know what you're agency. Talking about. Yeah,
holistic. Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. We got there.
Yeah.
So that series, the US version that was on Netflix, I just thought it was so bananas and amazing and wonderful. So, but I think the guy that directed it got into strife because of some stuff that he'd said or whatever. But that series I love. So working with something like that, I'd love to just completely mess with any of the Marvel or DC IPs. Just do something very weird and strange with any of their. So you know what I would like? I would like, and this is going to sound really. So one of the things I don't like about superheroes is that it's very rare that they get a permanent injury that never heals. So Superman to lose a limb and what does life mean for him after that, you know, or something to happen that's a permanent thing. I'd love to get a precious character that we all love and just do something really rough that he or she has to deal with, you know, and the story is about them dealing with that thing and, you know, something that puts some more stakes in there, not just my aunt dies or my uncle dies again, or but you know, something really, you know, intense. So who knows, but Yeah, so if Marvel want me to destroy one of their IP, they send it my way.
No,
destroy. And I'll give it a go.
I just want to lightly cripple them. What?
just a little bit. Just, you know, so maybe their face is around the back of their head now, and that's just the way they have to live. Something like that.
There's something different about you. I'm not too sure. What do you mean? Maybe you should talk about that. I'm okay.
Turn around. Yeah.
I am turn around. Turn around. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Now I have to sadly, we've got to bring this to an end. Can you tell the lovely people how they can find you out there, Morgan? How did you find you on these interwebs?
It's so easy. You can just find me at www. You don't even need the W. I don't know why we even do that anymore. Just go to morganquaid.com. You can find all my stuff there. You can find me on social media. And by all means, ask questions, talk to me, get involved. Anything you want to know, I'm happy to chat. But morganquaid.com is probably the easiest and quickest place to find me and my things and my stuff.
Excellent. I'll put all of the information to the show notes into the description so you can find Morgan out there. Yes, and if he hasn't lightly crippled one of your favorite superheroes, don't worry. He's a nice chap.
I'll be back. Yeah, they'll be back. It's fine.
With a limp. That's another story. I'd like to say thank you to you, Morgan. Thank you for coming on today. You have been a superstar. Thanks,
hey. Thank you, sir.
Oh, no worries at all. And I'd like to thank you, my friends. My life warriors are out there watching us up until this point to the very end. Much appreciated. Please stay safe, stay well, be awesome, be excellent, be fantastic. Be all the positive bees you can be in this world and then some. Yeah. Peace.
Cheers.
There you go. And we're